This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, August 19th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Arcom Printing, located on the hillside just east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, staying safe while exercising in the heat. We talked to a University of Arkansas researcher about the science studying the causes of heat stroke and related conditions. Plus, Northwest Arkansas Community College is partnering with various organizations to help teach the community more about America's music. Also, the latest installment of Arkansongs, Roby Brock from Talk Business Arkansas has his weekly business news recap and more. But first, the newly built C&H Hog Farm near the Buffalo River may be getting additional water quality inspections. Governor Mike Beebe says he wants to use $250,000 of surplus money to have the University of Arkansas monitor potential waste runoff from the farm. The operation is the first concentrated animal feeding operation in the state. In his weekly radio address, Beebe said the unique designation of a national river requires extra protections.
I recognize that the stakes are especially high when the Buffalo River is involved, and there may be future legislation proposed to address this specific issue. For the immediate future, I expect that this extra monitoring will put minds at ease and ensure that America's first national river will always be protected and preserved.
Beebe needs the approval of the Legislative Council and is seeking the appropriation in November. The CARE Foundation has announced a number of grant awards to community health and wellness projects in Northwest Arkansas. The grants were announced this morning and totaled just more than $1.6 million. Specific awards include $1 million to the City of Bentonville's Community Center Project, $350,000 to the Lake Springdale Trailhead Project, $10,000 to Northwest Arkansas Community College and the Northwest Arkansas Council Diversity Resource Guide, $30,000 to the Springdale Rotary Adventure Park, and just more than $240,000 to the UAMS Northwest Internal Medicine Residency Training Program. The CARE Foundation is a fund of the Endeavor Foundation, and Endeavor President Anita Chisholm says the projects receiving awards will have a significant impact of wellness in the region.
The Springdale Trailhead will certainly help people have access to the Razorback Regional Greenway, and the Bentonville Community Center will also be providing fitness activities for our residents. So I think those are two really great opportunities to contribute to the wellness of our people. And then also the UAMS project is certainly going to help the internal medicine residency training program. So that's going to not only provide great health care for our people, but it will be a recruitment tool to help keep our doctors in the area of Northwest Arkansas.
Chisholm says this round of community grants comes after $1.8 million in other grants given out by the CARE Foundation earlier this year.
The earlier round was contributing mostly to some multi-year grants that we were already committed to, and they were mainly in education in the school systems, Bentonville and Springdale mainly. So this is adding on to what the Northwest Arkansas Council has done through its Northwest Regional Development Strategy.
With the grants awarded this year, the CARE Foundation has awarded more than $55 million in community grants since 1999. Students in Arkansas are heading back to school today, and Red Cross officials in the state say parents and guardians need to have up-to-date emergency contact information. Bridget Williams with the Arkansas Red Cross says children and school administrators need to know what a parent expects if a crisis happens during school hours.
Unfortunately, we live in an age where schools are put on lockdown because of events that happen outside of the school. We've had weather issues where schools have either needed to be released early. We've had a series of tornadoes where schools were on lockdown and parents are at that point asked not to come to the school to get kids. But just it's still, depending on where you are, the school needs to get in touch with you. And most schools now are using automatic calling.
William says as a parent or guardian, you need to have current and accurate phone numbers registered with the school, and you should include contact information for another person who has authorization to act on your behalf if you cannot be reached by phone or text. Average retail prices for gasoline in Arkansas have climbed during the past week, but prices are still below where they were at this time last year. According to Gas Buddy's daily survey of more than 1,800 gas stations in Arkansas, the average price for gas rose by 0.6 cents for the week, ending at $3.32 per gallon yesterday. Including the increase, the average price per gallon of gas is 19.5 cents lower than it was 1 year ago, and 14.7 cents per gallon lower than prices were 1 month ago. The already crowded race for the 4th District seat in the U.S. Congress has gotten a little more crowded as Hot Springs businessman Tommy Mall announced his candidacy for the seat. Mall is running on the Republican ticket and has previously worked in the energy and mining industries. In his announcement released this morning, Mall says the top priorities of his campaign will be jobs and the economy, though specific details of his platform have yet to be released. Mike Ross has received a boost to his own campaign. Governor Mike Beebe officially endorsed Ross Saturday at the state capitol. Ross and Governor Beebe have had a working relationship since their days in the Arkansas Senate. Upon making the announcement, Governor Beebe said, quote, Mike Ross will unite the state with a bipartisan focus on education, job creation, and tax reform, and he will serve as the hardworking, compassionate leader we need to continue moving Arkansas forward, end quote. Ross is the only Democrat contender for governor in next year's election. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals lost 2-1 against the San Antonio Missions this weekend at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. The Nats have tonight off, but return to the field tomorrow when they travel to Springfield for a 4-game series against the Cardinals. Mostly cleared tonight with lows from 59 in Northwest Arkansas to 68 in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow with highs from 85 in Northwest Arkansas to 92 in the Arkansas River Valley. And mostly clear tomorrow night with lows from 62 degrees in Northwest Arkansas to 70 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Walmart has reported its earnings, and Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas tells us what that means for the overall U.S. economy in his weekly business news recap.
Sales grew and so did profits, but Bentonville-based Walmart had a rocky quarter as same-store sales struggled and the retail giant warned of a challenging environment for consumer spending. The company posted total quarterly revenues of nearly $117 billion. That was up from a year ago. Its net income rose to more than $4 billion. Same-store sales at its U.S. outlets actually were down 0.3% for the quarter, although its smaller Sam's Club division same-store sales rose 1.7%. Walmart said modest inflation and an increase in payroll taxes in the U.S. contributed to the struggling numbers. The retailer halved its forecast for expected sales growth for the remainder of the year. Not a good sign in terms of consumer spending. Lower revenue didn't impair Dillard's bottom line as the Little Rock-based retailer reported second quarter net income of $36.5 million. That's up from $31 million 1 year ago. Sales slipped to $1.48 billion in the second quarter. Dillard said that sales trends were notably strong in ladies' accessories and lingerie, followed by juniors and children's apparel. That makes sense with it being back-to-school season. Sales were weakest in the home and furniture category. Little Rock-based Axiom says it has laid off 20 people working in the database giant's U.S. marketing department. The layoffs occurred on Wednesday, with most of them happening at the company's Little Rock headquarters. The company employs about 5,200 people worldwide, with more than 2,000 of those working in Arkansas. Viking Farms, a poultry processing company, will locate a new processing facility in Arkadelphia, which will employ more than 172 people within the next 4 years. Viking will invest $5.4 million in the plant, formerly home to Petitjean Poultry. In addition to the jobs created directly by the new processing facility, Viking will also contract with a significant number of growers from the El Dorado and Union County areas, along with a Viking-supported hatchery in Prescott. Statistics released by the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services show that while hourly manufacturing wages are rising in Arkansas, the number of hours worked in manufacturing is on the decline. As a result, average weekly earnings in Arkansas are down 2.5%. Business leaders say productivity gains are leading to smaller workforces in the sector, which accounts for some, but not all, of the hourly wage increases, but lower overall earnings. And finally, State Representative Warwick Sabin of Little Rock will leave his post as publisher of the Oxford American Magazine and take the helm of the Arkansas Regional Innovation Hub, an entrepreneurship nonprofit launching in downtown North Little Rock's Argenta District. The Innovation Center was announced last month and will promote entrepreneurship through business incubation, academic research, technical and manufacturing assistance, and job training. Sabin will assume his responsibilities on September 1st. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. Next week, the Tribeca Film Institute and the National Endowment for the Humanities, in partnership with Northwest Arkansas Community College and Walton Art Center, will begin a 6-week series of programs focusing on music in America. The program will take place Wednesday evenings at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville and is called America's Music, a Film History of Our Popular Music from Blues to Bluegrass to Broadway. Each program will include a documentary film screening, live music, and a discussion led by Miles Fish, professor of music at NWAC. Fish says while they can tweak things as they go along, he does have a plan for the first event in the series, which is scheduled for August 28th and will focus on jazz.
I think we'll have a little live music as people come in. And I think on the screen we'll have some vintage posters and shots of jazz bands, et cetera, going on to kind of get people in the mood. And then we'll very little talking from us. And then we'll just introduce the documentary film, and we'll watch the documentary film or portions of that documentary film. And then immediately after the film, we'll talk about it, and we'll talk about them. And then we'll have a little live music. So that's how we have the first one set up. If we decide, you know, it may have been better if we'd done this and this and this, we'll stay flexible. We'll do it differently on the second one.
Fish says it's taken about 1.5 years for this program to come to fruition. It started when NWAC received an announcement from the Tribeca Film Institute announcing it had funding for 50 different events in the country that involved communities learning more about American music. After filling out an application and being selected, Fish, along with Stacy Winchester, reference coordinator librarian at NWAC, traveled to Chicago for training for the program. Fish says part of the training focused on how to lead discussions at each event.
We're not up there to teach rock and roll. We're not up there to teach jazz. We're up there to show these wonderful documentaries, which we viewed while we were up there, and then to let the community that's there that night discuss what it means to their culture and what it means to them. And one of the interesting things about American music is we forget that it's fairly recent phenomenon. And so we have, well, you take, for instance, my mother was born in 1926. She's still alive. So she has stories about what it may have been like to go to big band jazz and when my dad was stationed in the service in Long Beach and when they went to the USO clubs and things like that. One thing they wanted to impress on us was the fact that these people aren't going to be here with us. My mom's 88, not going to be here with us forever. And we need to get those stories. So these sessions, the discussion sessions about what American music means to the culture in general and what it means to that individual will all be recorded and they'll be sent on to the Tribeca Film Festival and for them to archive these stories from our community.
The series is being funded through a pair of grants, a $2,500 grant from the National Endowment of the Humanities and a $2,000 innovation grant from NWAC. Miles Fish, professor of music at NWAC, says when he and Stacy Winchester, reference coordinator librarian at NWAC, attended training, their expenses were underwritten by their respective departments, so all of the grant money could be used for the program itself. Each week, a different genre will be the subject of the evening's event. The America's Music series will feature jazz, Broadway, rock, blues, hip-hop, and bluegrass. A big component behind the program is education. Guests can start the learning experience before attending a session by reading notes about a specific genre at americasmusicbentonville.org. One possible obstacle in the education process is attracting someone to learn about a new genre if they are convinced they are only interested in another, say, jazz or blues.
First of all, I want people to come and enjoy the music and enjoy the wonderful documentaries and enjoy the discussion. Second of all, I would hope that they would see this as a series, as not as a cafeteria plan to, as you say, go through and, well, I like jazz and I like blues, but that's the only thing I care about. So I'm going to that one and that one. So I would hope that they would see it as a complete unit of all six lectures, and that out of this, they would discover possibly an interest in another genre that they didn't know they had. Either the history of the genre intrigued them, or hearing it played live intrigued them, but they went on to discover they have a new love, and that love is Broadway, or that love is blues, or gospel, or whatever. So that would be, I guess, the second thing that I would hope would happen. And then the third we've already talked about, I would hope that people would come prepared to talk about music and how it parallels American culture.
The first installment of America's Music, a film history of our popular music from blues to bluegrass to Broadway, begins at 6:30 p.m. August 28th in the Great Hall at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, and it will focus on jazz. Each of the six sessions will begin at 6:30 Wednesday evenings. The event is free and open to the public. Audience members may reserve seats online at crystalbridges.org or by visiting Museum Guest Services. Walk-in seating will be available on a first-come, first-served basis. More information is available at americasmusicbentonville.org. It is Monday, August 19th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And we have to quit talking about Justin Cunningham, who we're still thinking about from yesterday, and talk about auditions so you, too, can go do theater.
Okay.
These are all opportunities at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
All right.
Cinderella auditions.
Oh, that was my favorite movie as a kid.
7 o'clock, August 26th and 27th. This is part of their children's season. And so, of course, they're looking for Cinderella, her fairy godmother, the handsome prince, and the wicked stepsisters. We should go do theater.
Oh, we should. You want to be
a wicked? Yeah.
Yeah, wicked stepsisters, obviously.
No sex, please. We're British. You know, one of those British farces where doors slam and identities are confused. And auditions are at 7 o'clock, September 9th and 10th, looking for four women from the age range of 25 to 60-ish and seven men of the same age range. The premise is that a young bride is living above a bank with her husband. She sends off a mail order for Scandinavian glassware and gets Scandinavian pornography.
And hilarity ensues.
And hilarity ensues. And auditions at 1 o'clock on September 21st for the biggest Christmas tradition, I would venture to say, in Springdale.
Yes.
The best Christmas pageant ever.
I forget what year this is of them doing it.
314.
Probably.
It's over 20. But there was a sabbatical in the middle. So nobody's quite sure how to count
it. Okay.
This, of course, is the Christmas tale of the Herdman children, who are horrible children, and go to the church play rehearsal because there are cookies. And, of course, everything ends happily. Looking for five women from 25 to 60, two men from 30 to 60, and 50-plus children.
Lots of children.
From grades 2 through 9.
Mm-hmm.
Go have a great time.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Thank you. Arkansas-er Monk Higgins was born Milton Bland on October 17, 1936, in Menifee in Conway County. With his mother in the church choir, he grew up around gospel music, but became interested in sports. He was said to be given the tuba in band because he was the only student big enough to carry it around. However, music stuck with Higgins, and he became a music major at Arkansas State University in Jonesboro, and additionally studied at the Chicago School of Music in Illinois. Monk Higgins' first music teaching job was in Hayti, Missouri, and then he went back to Chicago Public Schools, where he later left teaching to become a social worker in Cook County. The wide-ranging musical talents of Monk Higgins went beyond merely being a multi-instrumentalist specializing in saxophone. In the early 1960s, Monk Higgins returned to music as an arranger for Wonderful Records, and then as a performer, composer, and arranger for Chess and St. Lawrence Records, all of Chicago, Illinois. The latter label issued his instrumental, Who Done It, and it became an R&B hit in 1966. On the B-side was the mellower, These Days Are Filled With You, heard here. The new decade dawned, the Arkansas-er packed his horns and relocated to Los Angeles, California. Monk Higgins began arranging music and producing acts for various companies, including United Artists Records, for whom he also became a performer. Gotta Be Funky, heard here, from his 1972 solo album Heavyweight, became his biggest hit, rising to number 22 R&B. Monk Higgins signed to New York's Buddha Records in the mid-1970s and worked on the label's soundtrack to the 1975 Pam Grier film Sheba Baby, and released the solo album Dance to the Disco Sax of Monk Higgins. Throughout the decade and into the 1980s, the ever-busy Monk Higgins continued branching out, composing music for products like Toyota and Mogan David Wine. Meanwhile, Higgins was music director at the South Central Los Angeles nightclub Memory Lane, owned by actress Marla Gibbs, best known for playing Florence on TV's The Jeffersons. Named for his first hit song, Monk Higgins' Whodunit band included guitarist Keb Moe, who credits Higgins with his musical development. During this time, Higgins worked with fellow Arkansas-er Al Bell, composing and producing albums for Bobby Blue Bland. Higgins also produced or wrote songs for Etta James, Blue Mitchell, fellow Arkansas-ers Freddie Robinson and Sun Seals, and many others. With the advent of hip-hop, the riffs and beats of Monk Higgins became heavily sampled by Big Daddy Kane, Beck, Biz Markie, LL Cool J, Gangstar, and more. While the new century saw Monk Higgins being sampled by the likes of Judicus, Raekwon, and John Legend. Multi-talented and much sampled musician, composer, producer, arranger, public school teacher, social worker, and Arkansas-er, Monk Higgins died on July 3, 1986 in Los Angeles, California. Monk Higgins was 49 years old. Here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Milton Bland, or Monk Higgins, of Menifee and Conway County with Gotta Be Funky from his 1972 album with the specialties Heavyweight.
Arkansas, your Monk Higgins of Menifee in southeast Conway County with Gotta Be Funky from 1972. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
Today, public schools across the state are open for business, and students grades 9 through 12 for the first time will be taught English, language arts, and math under the new National Common Core Standards. Common Core Standards for mathematics and English language arts were first introduced in lower grades. This year, high school students will experience a new interdisciplinary approach to learning literacy in math. Tracy Tucker is Director of Curriculum and Instruction at the Arkansas Department of Education.
One of the biggest areas that we see that is very different from what we have done historically in Arkansas in literacy deals with students being able to read, write, think, and speak in literacy across all content areas. So, for example, we want our students in history classes to learn to read, write, and think like a historian. In our science classes, we want them to read, write, and think like scientists. And so that is a bit of a stretch for us from where we've been in the past, in that we have really just focused on content from those particular areas and not necessarily brought in that literacy piece in our instruction in our schools.
45 states have adopted curriculum and assessments under Common Core, which was approved in Arkansas by the Board of Education in 2010.
The Common Core state standards are a set of standards that were developed by states, by educators within those states, that are aligned to college and career readiness. So their emphasis is on making sure that students have the skills, the knowledge, and are able to perform the skills that they need in order to be college and career ready when they leave our schools. So we have had standards in the state of Arkansas for years that spell out what it is that students are expected to know, understand, and be able to do. These standards are just more rigorous and aligned to college and career readiness.
K through 12 science classes will remain the same pending release of Common Core Next Generation Science Standards. Arkansas will also implement a new assessment system beginning in the 2014-2015 school year. Until then, Arkansas benchmark and end of course exams will be the standard to assess students in mathematics, English language arts, and science. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The fall sports seasons for high schools and colleges begin soon, and the practices for football, soccer, volleyball, and other sports have already begun. For athletes and others spending time outdoors, attention has to be paid to how the body is behaving during exercise in the heat. Last week, research conducted by the University of Arkansas and the University of Connecticut examined how some high school athletes at Bentonville and Rogers reacted to an experimental cooling device. Brendan McDermott is a professor of kinesiology at the University of Arkansas. Last week, he talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the research, as well as about the science studying the causes of heat stroke and related conditions.
Hydration is a main component that is present most often with heat exhaustion and exertional heat stroke, but it's not a necessity. You can have exertional heat stroke and not necessarily be dehydrated, but it's one of the things that we can end up doing, obviously, to prevent. And it's one of the things that is behaviorally, because there's some other innate things that may contribute to exertional heat stroke that maybe are out of our control. But so in terms of performance and feeling good when we're gardening or mowing the lawn and exerting ourselves perhaps minimally, it is more dehydration, perhaps heat exhaustion if it is an extreme heat that can affect us. Exertional heat stroke typically does come into play when it is at least moderate or long-term duration exertion. So right. Moderate to extreme exertion. You know, and a lot of times in athletics, it comes into play where we have – somebody may actually feel symptoms or they may not feel symptoms of heat exhaustion. So things like dizziness, nausea, we may get lightheaded, just an overwhelming feeling of heat and that sort of thing. Yet at the same time, a coach may be annoyed at how the team's performing and blowing a whistle and saying, give me 10 push-ups, do some up-downs, give me some more sprints, and pushing people beyond what their normal limits are. That's when we're seeing it, or when somebody has a goal time in a distance race. Mm-hmm. So a half marathon or a marathon type distance, and somebody has a goal time and they're really pushing towards that, or the last 2 miles they step it up and I'm almost at my goal time, let me do this, and then they sprint it in and the next thing you know they collapse, and they never really had any signs and symptoms of heat stroke per se, but they felt fatigued obviously because they were pushing it towards the end, but they had that goal in mind and they're pushing for it.
I would think that in that situation, and perhaps in a sports practice as well, it's hard for the athlete to sometimes realize, because of course I'm fatigued. I'm at the end of I'm 24 miles into a run,
yes,
or I'm an hour and a half into this practice.
Yes.
So I should be feeling fatigued. So knowing the difference between what would be a normal fatigue, yeah, and what is potentially dangerous.
And it does become a little different too. It's difficult to determine, is it dangerous or is it not? Because there's a lot of things. It's a multitude of things that can lead to exertional heat stroke. So one of which is pushing through some of those signs and symptoms. But, you know, normal fatigue, you would expect athletes to kind of know, mm-hmm, this is normal fatigue versus not so normal fatigue. They probably should tell somebody. We also like to promote in sports medicine and athletic training that there's kind of a buddy system where if you're in your group and you're a lineman or you're a wide receiver and you're in a huddle with your people or at a practice doing drills with your people and with your buddy, if they're not acting right, tell somebody and then they can watch you. Or
because you're not always the best judge of your own.
Absolutely. So a lot of times in athletics, what leads to success is pushing through some of those things, especially in distance events or intense practices and intense activity. Sometimes that's why we do it. Sometimes it's one of those, it's a motivating thing.
So how do you know if you're not, quote, the professional or truly experienced athlete that this is normal fatigue?
You don't. And that's what makes it difficult. So, yeah. You could err on the side of caution. Or one of the things that I always like to tell people, too, is if there is an organized event like that, that is a distance event where those types of things are a potential, is pay attention and ask questions. For example, what is the medical scenario that exists in this marathon? Mm-hmm. You know, so if I do succumb to one of these and I do collapse, or somebody collapses at mile 25, who's going to take care of me? Is there an emergency action plan? Are there AEDs around? Get the bigger things out of the way. Just ask a question. What's the medical coverage? And, you know, if it seems appropriate, that's something to pay attention to. There are people specifically trained to recognize and treat these things. You know, hydration for the average individual out there is pretty easy to pay attention to. So if you're thirsty, pretty much you're 2% dehydrated or more. Mm. And you can think about it in terms of urine color is something that's been recommended. Some people recently have touted it not being the most accurate because there's supplements and there's different things in our diet that may change color. But if we're consistent with those things, like a multivitamin may change color a little bit. But if it's, you know, darker one day than it is another day, dark means that you're more dehydrated.
And there are a lot of people who want to run a marathon and not have to stop.
Of course.
You know, so they try to – is that wise to try to not have to urinate during 26.2 miles?
It's a hindrance for your time perhaps.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend we purposely dehydrate to run a marathon to not have to pee. But the other way I always tell people, and we'd recommend, that experts have been recommending for a few years now, is sweat rate is different for everybody. And that really determines how much we should be consuming. Because the major concern now in a lot of the distance races has been, especially the extreme distance races, mm-hmm, where it may take us 24 hours, the potential does exist for us to overhydrate during some of those and treat dehydration as the main thing that is going to be a hindrance for us. So we overconsume fluids. In fact, I know of a case in a half marathon of a woman that gained 12 pounds.
She gained 12 pounds while running a half
running
marathon?
Running 13 miles, yes.
Oh,
and
gosh,
she ended up having, you know, exertional hyponatremia and dying. So,
oh my gosh,
it's potentially fatal the opposite way. So balance is a big thing. And sweat rate varies largely. So there are very small people that are, you know, 150 pounds that may sweat 3 or 4 liters an hour, mm-hmm, participating. And there's other people that same size, shape, everything – that sweat maybe 1 liter an hour. So in essence, your rehydration goals are going to be starkly different between those two individuals. So the biggest thing, recommendation that I have for everybody is you pay attention to urine color, you pay attention to thirst, and you also know your own sweat rate in terms of athletic activity or exercise outdoors. And to measure your sweat rate is very simple. If you're going outside to do a workout, you take your body weight beforehand with as little clothing on as feasible. You go exercise and you weigh yourself again afterwards. And if you consume fluid during activity, you would just add that.
How much fluid?
Back into your post weight. So it's pre-weight minus post weight. And then if you work out for an hour, that would be your sweat rate. That's how much you lose per hour in sweat.
That's interesting.
And if it's a half hour, double it. That's how much you lose per hour. So if you're going to run a marathon, you should measure your sweat rate in similar conditions at a similar intensity that you're going to run your marathon. And you should have a general idea about, okay, during my trials of doing sweat rate, measure it a few times, make sure it's slightly accurate.
Right.
Because one time may not be the most accurate. But if you do that a couple times, you educate yourself on your own sweat rate, and you can basically plan it out where, okay, in the marathon now, I know I should be consuming this much.
Well, let's talk about some of the research that was happening here, because this is preseason for high school football. You went to some high school, I believe, in Rogers and Bentonville practices this week. What was happening there?
Well, for them, it was preseason football.
Right.
For us, it was an important field study. We were collecting a number of variables on our athletes or our participants that were helping us out with research. So we had a lot of technology with us, but the true ultimate goal of the study was to determine a hand cooling device, its effectiveness in preventing a rise in core temperature during what we were presuming would be exercise in the heat.
Right.
It wasn't as hot as we had expected, but either case, the athletes are stressed because it's preseason, so they may not be completely heat acclimatized at this point in time. This is the first week in Arkansas that they can participate with full pads and do full contact at practice. So the biggest thing that we were testing, the main outcome variable for us, is the rise in core temperature during practice. So somebody starts out at normal body temperature of, you know, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and then we look to see if there are differences with matched controls. So what we did is we matched people based on body size and position and supposed exercise as well. So if you're a first-string person, most likely at practice you're going to get the same amount of reps. So what we did is we kind of matched people up accordingly and had one person get cooled every break from Tuesday through Friday's practice. And then his match got in the control condition, which was no cooling, but still got monitored.
This glove, it just fits on your hand?
It actually slides on your hand, and it has the same material. It has to create a tight seal on your forearm because the technology that's within it is a vacuum, and there is also a bladder inside that fills up with cold water and continuously circulates cold water. So in essence, what it's doing is the vacuum allows maximum blood flow to the palm, which is a good place to extract heat from the body. So your palm and your feet. We didn't have people take off their shoes and do the foot at the same time, and the glove is specifically for your hands. But in essence, what the goal is to vacuum, you know, make a tight seal, vacuum the blood flow right to the periphery, and then circulate the cold water so that as blood is flowing through the palm, you're extracting heat from the body. We were only doing this during break times. So we weren't controlling practice. We didn't tell the coaches you need to take a 10-minute break every 30 minutes. We did observational study. So they took we were measuring core temperature with an ingestible thermistor. So it really is a pill that people take.
Right.
And it transmits a radio signal based on their core body temperature.
It's amazing what technology allows you to study now.
It is very neat when you're looking at these things. Absolutely. It's cool.
And so the pill is swallowed, and then it passes through the body after a time. But you can use that to get that core temperature.
Yes.
And read it.
So it transmits a radio signal. So during practice, we're walking up to our research subjects, those that took the pill, and just near their abdomen, you know, front or back, it transmits about 3 to 5 feet. And you just plug in a number that corresponds to their participant number, and there's their core temperature, so we write it down.
And this is research, and you never know, and there are variables, and I don't want you to be – I'm not going to put you in the position to say, well, this means this or this means that. I understand how research works. But in a good world, this research will lead to
– it would lead to preventing heat illness and heat strokes, honestly. And at the same time, it may actually lead to better improved performance because most athletes that – feel better will also perform better.
But this is also something that could be used for the guy who's flagging traffic when you're paving or someone who is in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the main thing that we're looking at is safety for people. And anybody that's exposed to the heat, whether it be in industry or construction or military, then has a chance to take a break. This research would apply to because they're doing strenuous activity in the heat and then they're taking a break and then doing strenuous activity in the heat repeatedly throughout their day, whether it's for work or military or what have you or athletics.
Could we call this cutting edge technology what you were working with this week?
Well, it is cutting edge technology. Okay. I mean, I look at it as there's a multitude of things out there that people have done to help prevent heat illness. Some of which have been shown to work, others of which have been shown to not really be that effective. So this is one of the things that in laboratory settings has shown some pretty good benefit with both core temperature and performance. So that is what draws people into its, you know, use. This is the first field study, to my knowledge, where it's been brought out of laboratory to see what happens in observational conditions when we're not controlling this. But we had enough data to look at what exercise people were doing to see if we found a true match for these individuals. And again, I mean, the hope is we're making it safer for a lot of people, anybody who's exposed to heat.
A couple weeks ago, I met some high school students who were part of an engineering camp at the University of Arkansas working on a solar boat project. Turns out it was a cloudy day and they couldn't really get the things going. And their mentors that day said, this is what sometimes happens with research, that conditions aren't what you think they will be. On paper.
Yes.
First week of organized football practice with pads in Arkansas in August. This should be, you know, boy, here's the study for heat because it's going to be the last 2 Augusts we've been in triple digits. You have one of the coolest Augusts on record.
Yes.
Does that make a difference?
You know, it's interesting. And we as a research team are not delighted to see the temperatures. Last week, I know there's people flying in from Connecticut and Florida to assist in the research. And, you know, I texted them at one point and was like, did you look at the weather? And they're like, why? And I said, look at it. And they came back with, is this Fayetteville, Arkansas, really? I think we looked at the 10-year average, too, and it's almost 20 degrees cooler than normal. In this case, what we look at, though, is that football players exercising in the heat, the uniform is really preventive for alleviating or dissipating heat for us. So essentially, the uniform creates a microenvironment inside it, and our bodies lose heat most effectively through sweat evaporation. So if the body is covered with what won't allow evaporative cooling, essentially it's not cooling anyways. So it may start out at a little bit cooler temperature, but the rate of rise really is determined by how much work they're doing because their evaporative sweat loss is not really there. So there's only about a third of their body that's available for evaporative sweat loss. So in conditions like this, it does reduce the risk of a rise in temperature, and we may see temperatures in our research subjects that were not as high as what they would have been. But all in all, we still saw some decently high temperatures in our athletes. So I mean, the comparison is still there, and the athletes were all – their counterpart or their matched control was still participating in the same conditions.
Brendan McDermott is a professor of kinesiology at the University of Arkansas. Last week, researchers at the U of A and the University of Connecticut studied a cooling apparatus with the cooperation of high school athletes in Bentonville and Rogers. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is our own Christina Thomas. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you for stopping by today. You had an exciting weekend. Well, a very interesting Saturday morning.
I did. I did indeed. I went skydiving.
That's pretty great.
Right. I did a story on the Child Advocacy Center of Benton County. This is their fourth annual Skydive for Kids event. Last year, they raised about $40,000. They don't have the numbers in this
Quite
year
because mm-hmm.
it was just this weekend.
Sure.
But yeah, they had 27 jumpers, and I was one of them.
And you had never been skydiving before?
I never had, no.
Okay, and I understand you got some sound while you were out there?
I did. They record everything to give you a DVD, and I asked for the audio from that recording.
What are we doing today, Christina?
Skydiving!
Woo! What makes you want to do something like that?
I'm crazy!
You're crazy?
Crazy.
We're going in that plane right behind you over there. Are you ready to go have some fun?
I guess so.
You know it's dangerous, right?
That's what they say.
Yeah? How'd you get yourself into this?
I think you talked me into it.
I think so?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
So you go in the morning and you have a couple hours of training. Is that about right?
It was really just 15 minutes of training.
Okay.
There's not much to it.
I really didn't know how much it was. But you did a tandem jump, so you're with someone else. You're not by yourself, so that requires a lot less.
Right. He's doing all the work.
Right.
I just have to trust him.
And I knew you were excited going out to it, but I always wonder if it's, you know, like one of those roller coasters that somebody gets to the top, they're really excited, and then all of a sudden they're just like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. At any point, were you ever nervous or questioning your decision to do this?
For sure. We were in a teeny tiny plane. And climbing up to 10,000 feet mm-hmm. took about 10 or 15 minutes.
Oh.
And so you have 10 or 15 minutes to just sort of sit there and look out the window and think about what you're getting ready to do.
And you were thinking about not doing it?
I don't think I was necessarily thinking about not doing it, but I was like, why am I doing this? And you might even be able to hear a little bit of that right here.
Door back and you're ready to jump. What were you thinking at that point?
It was again, why am I doing this? For sure. It's scary to put your foot out on like that. There's a step that you put your foot out on.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the winds, I don't even know how fast they're going, but they're going fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to trust your guy. And Brad Barnett, he was great. I am so glad that I was with him. He's really good at his job, for sure.
And what did it feel like falling, that far from a plane?
You kind of black out for a second, really.
Really?
It was just kind of like, and there you go. I mean, you're going 120 miles an hour before the parachute
that fast
opens.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was... it didn't really feel like it, but it was about 45 seconds of free fall before he actually opened the parachute. And I really liked the parachute. You can actually hear me say, I like the free fall, And then once the parachute opened, I was like, oh, I'm glad the parachute opened, but I kind of want to be free falling again.
But kind of nice feeling of just falling. I've always wondered if it would be hard to breathe. Because, you know, on like a roller coaster, when you drop, sometimes it's a little hard to catch your breath. And when you're falling that fast, I was wondering if it was the same kind of effect.
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is.
What do you think about that?
That was crazy.
You did it.
Glad the parachute opened.
How was that range of emotions?
So once your feet are back on the ground and you have successfully landed with your parachute open and everything, what were your final thoughts on the whole process?
I was speechless. I was definitely speechless for a little while. And I was probably shaking for an hour and a half afterward. It's an incredible adrenaline rush. I think I was speechless and then awesome. Just awesome.
Ready to do it again?
Yep, I am.
Well, thank you to you for sharing your story. Thanks to the folks out at Skydive Ranch.
Skydive Sky Ranch.
Thank you. And congratulations to the
Child Advocacy Center of Benton County.
Yes, for another successful fundraiser.
Now that I know that the parachute is open, I kind of wouldn't mind free falling.
All right.
The Jazz Eureka 2013 Festival begins Friday, September 13th, and will run through Sunday the 15th. This three-day event will include both free and ticketed music and events. Performers include the Fayetteville Jazz Collective, Walter Savage Trio, and more. Information is available on the web at eurekasprings.org. If you have Alzheimer's disease or think you may have Alzheimer's disease, Health Initiatives Research is seeking participants to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of an oral study drug that may slow the progression of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. More information is available at 871-1771. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Siloam Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. And to all the students and teachers returning to school today, I hope you're having a wonderful first day of class.